This is Judaism Unbound, episode 38, Judaism and Evolving Dharma. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
We're here today in the second of four episodes on the sensibilities that will guide the future of Jewish life with our guest Jay Michelson. We sort of tongue-in-cheek think of this as the non-Jewish sensibilities episode. Jay is going to help us think about how, as a future Judaism comes about, how the kinds of Jewish sensibilities that we talked with John Wucher and Lee Moore about last week might intermix with sensibilities that come from other sources. Jay, in particular, is an expert in Buddhism. He has written about it in a book called Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment. In addition to that, Jay is probably the most overqualified person we've ever had on the show. He has a PhD from Hebrew University in Jewish thought. He has a JD from Yale Law School, an MFA from Sarah Lawrence, a BA from Columbia, and also he has rabbinic ordination, non-denominational rabbinic ordination. He has written six books. He is a columnist for the Jewish Daily Forward, very famously in the Jewish community. He also is a columnist for the Daily Beast, and he is the founder of two LGBT Jewish organizations, a very frequent speaker at Jewish gatherings, someone who is really kind of provoking us to think seriously in Jewish life about everything in different ways. And we are incredibly excited to have Jay with us today on Judaism Unbound. Jay, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
To get started, we really wanted to go into this topic of, you know, what we sort of are calling Jewish sensibilities and non-Jewish sensibilities, for want of a better pithy way of talking about it. But the basic idea is that as we look at the Judaism of the future, the question, in a sense, is what Jewish material is going to be mixed in inside the Judaism of the future, and then what material that comes from outside of Judaism is going to be mixed into that material. And I know that that's something that you've probably thought on both sides of that ledger, and you've definitely written about the role of Eastern religion and Eastern ideas coming into Judaism. And so I was hoping you could just start by talking about some of that stuff and how you think about how you're thinking about it these days.
You know, I think sensibility is an interesting word, an interesting place to kind of start. I was just actually editing a piece on a totally separate subject, kind of the evolution of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender theologies, and talking about the concept of a gay sensibility in religious conversation, and thinking of it as less about content, it's not about verses or something like that, and more about style. You know, kind of certain kind of irony or almost a camp sensibility and things like that too. You know, I think we're at a transitional moment on the Jewish sensibility side, because what we've seen and understood to be a Jewish sensibility for the last, I don't know, 50 odd years post-war America is clearly shifting, right? And you know, it was understood that we even have shorthand phrases for it, like, oh, that person's a bagel and lox Jew. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a certain kind of Jew from, you know, Eastern European roots, or at least some kind of European, mostly Ashkenazic roots. But that may not appeal to a lot of people from Sephardic communities or backgrounds, or certainly Adot Mizrach and Mizrachi in Israel and things like that. You know, that's just a trivial example, but I think that's also true on deeper levels. It is this strange moment where the old school Jewish sensibilities are as ubiquitous as ever, right? So whether it's Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign or the eternal endurance of Seinfeld in syndicated television, there's a lot of like that kind of Judaism, probably more visible than, you know, than it has been in decades. And yet just at that moment, obviously through hybridization, through multiple faith marriages and families and other currents, that's shifting and it's transforming. You know, ironically for me, when I spend time in Buddhist spaces, because I teach meditation in a Buddhist lineage as well as being an ordained rabbi, it's actually some of the most Jewish spaces that I hang out in terms of sensibility, right? Because the Western Dharma was so heavily populated with American Jews, mostly secular American Jews, who brought their own sensibility and their own psychoanalytic perspective and their own kind of iterations of what the problem of humanity is and what it is to be happy and things like that. You know, some of that's determined by a North Indian prince from the Axial Age, but a lot of it is determined by people who would otherwise be psychoanalysts on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. So it's funny that in terms of sensibility, I think one reason that it's so easy to do that Buddhist-Jewish integration is that the kind of Dharma traditions, Buddhism, Hinduism, and others that are being integrated are already packaged for Western consumption by Asian teachers and then repackaged again by Western teachers.
So when people are resistant to the idea of Jewish syncretism, of the idea of other religious ideas coming into Judaism, I mean, when I hear that kind of resistance, I sort of laugh a little because I think about how much of Judaism in sort of every previous iteration involved so much importation of material from the cultures that the Jews were living in. You know, I'm thinking about rabbinic Judaism being so influenced by Greek thought, which was the dominant tradition, the dominant intellectual tradition of its time. And I remember when I was first encountering some of the people who were doing various Jewish versions of Eastern practices a decade or so ago, it just struck me as so obvious that, of course, that's the next stage because that is the main new thing going on in the society, in American society, in which the Jews are living. And so wouldn't it be the natural next step that we would start to see Eastern ideas coming into Judaism? And is that how you see it?
Sure, yeah. I think... You know, what you said is certainly right. I mean, there's a great irony of Jews sitting down to a Passover Seder, which is derived from a symposium and which was in part designed as a refutation of Jewish Christian claims in the first centuries of the Common Era and complaining about Jewish imports. or, you know, coming up on a harvest festival, which used to be a purely pagan or earth-based festival and then got overlaid with a Jewish narrative of, you know, the Exodus from Egypt or something like that, and then got overlaid with a different narrative, and also complaining about hybridization. It's like when, you know, especially like with Sukkot, you know, when Jews complain about, you know, paganism, and then they go wave their magical vegetables in the four directions, or the six directions, even more so. So that's certainly true. There is certainly always a concern, I think, about whether there's a dilution or a diminution of quality with this or that importation and syncretization. Interestingly, you know, if you really look at the sweep of Jewish history, it's rarely the ones who are hybridizing that actually you find a diminishment of rigor and discourse. It's actually more when the tradition ossifies or tries to isolate itself that it goes into a sort of wayward and weird direction. But, you know, I was just reading, there's a wonderful new academic book about the Sabbatean movement, you know, which at one point attracted as many as one-third of European Jews to an ultimately false messianic claim in the 17th century, and, you know, which led to a lot of experimentation and hybridization and new ideas and ultimately led to the rise of Hasidism and 20th century spirituality as we know it today, but which also represented a real trauma, you know, and that's always been 5 minutes to midnight in Jewish history. And so there's always been a fear that this next trauma is going to be the worst one ever. And sometimes those fears are realized.
And so how do you think about, I mean, this is something that we've been starting to sort of struggle with. We've been talking a lot about the process of change, but it's important to start to think a little bit about the content side of what Judaism is and might become. I mean, how do you think that modern Jews should be thinking about, you know, and I don't mean this in a simplistic way, but essentially what makes Judaism Judaism, you know, and how do we think about major changes in Judaism and, you know, on the one hand, being open to new importation and on the other hand, having some sense that, look, I mean, if the other thing was so great, why don't we just do that instead? Now we're free to, you know, what is the way to think about the material of Judaism and the material of other potential importations and the potential remix that results, you know, what ultimately makes it really Judaism?
For me, the answer has to be something about working with the set of tools and materials that are out there and that history has bequeathed us. And that's about it, you know, that there is this parameter of, you know, this is Jewish space, whatever that means, and here are the things that occur in Jewish space, and some kind of wrestling with that. And the reason I'm so minimalistic about the definition, you know, is that, you know, for many people, millions of people, this is an ethnicity marker, and it's about nationalism. And so they can't for the life of them understand why you wouldn't always root for our team as, you know, against some other team, mm-hmm. because that's what it is. This is about being on a team, and it's about being in a family and being in a group. And, you know, that's definitely not how I see it. I do see that as a little part, not even a little part, a significant part of Jewishness in the 21st century. But to me, when it's truest to the Judaism I'm interested in, to sometimes oppose Jews when they're on the wrong side of Jewish values, whether that's on, you know, some American political context or whether it's the context of Israel-Palestine or what have you. You know, I think that just as the prophets in ancient Israel opposed what the Israelites were doing sometimes, so too those of us who aspire to walk in their footsteps need to oppose what Jews are doing now. So it to me is not about just a team. You know, it'd be interesting to see if, Isaiah or Jeremiah were allowed to speak at a Hillel. I mean, they say such negative things about Israel. Maybe they shouldn't be allowed in.
Well, they weren't really warmly welcomed in their time either.
So that's I think that's why I have such a minimal definition. So for some people, obviously, it's religion. For some, it's culture. So even the type of activity that we're engaged in, and you know what it is that we're meant to be doing, it goes beyond for me like the substance. It's kind of like what's even the grammar of the sentence that we're trying to write or the question that we're trying to ask. It's not even just the vocabulary, and I think it's a little bit fruitless to insist that, oh, well, it has to have these ten characteristics, otherwise it's not really Jewish enough. You know, it's not even enough. It's not even adequate to say, well, Judaism is what Jews are doing, because it's also, you know, a lot of Jews are doing things that they don't identify as Judaism, and I'm not going to, you know, impose that definition on someone else. You know, it's like when people would insist before Steven Spielberg really became a Jewish director, you know, with Schindler's List and so on, like, is there something Jewish about Steven Spielberg? And, you know, I write for the Forward, they do this all the time, the secret Jewish history of Metallica or something. You know, for me, that's super, super uninteresting. I'm not going to delegitimize it. If that's what somebody's into, that's great. But, you know, for me, there are plenty of Jews who do things that aren't Judaism and aren't do things that aren't Jewish, probably a majority, actually. So even saying it's what people create is not quite up to par. So, you know, for me, it does have something to do with, are you playing in the sandbox? And if you choose to play in the sandbox from whatever position, whether it's being the bully in the sandbox or throwing sand in the bully's eyes in the sandbox, both are in the sandbox. And so it has something to do with that for me, which I realize is a little minimalistic. But I always come back to Kurt Vonnegut, one of his characters, I forget who it was, who was asked what the meaning of life is. I think it was his prophet, his religion. In Kurt Vonnegut books, he said, we're here to help each other get through this thing, whatever it is.
I am really intrigued by what you said about sort of the nationalistic element of Judaism and sort of rooting for a team almost as how some Jews engage in Judaism. And I was curious because a recent piece you wrote sort of brought up some of those themes, and I'd love to hear you expand. It was about Pokemon Go, which we've actually mentioned on some earlier episodes of ours. But I think that it's really important to think about how things like augmented reality and other technological shifts that are already that we're already experiencing or that we will experience, how those will affect our world and for those of us living in the Jewish world, how it'll affect Judaism. And I'm curious if you could expand on why it is that Pokemon Go might relate to a shift away from sort of the nationalist impulses or tribal impulses that you were talking about before.
So I think two reasons, but with a preface first, right? So Pokemon Go itself is just, you know, step 1.2 and, you know, a 1,000-step journey toward augmented reality, virtual reality, and so forth. So when we're talking about it, we're not really talking about Pokemon Go. We're talking about the trend that it's a very early, early, early exemplar of. It's like, you know, I dialed into my first bulletin board system in 1985 on a 300 baud modem. You know, I don't think we really understood what the internet was, but we understood that this was something new that was coming on that might change things. And that's where we are, I think, right now. So with Pokemon Go. But I think there are two reasons. First, you know, it illustrates how communities can be formed in a kind of ad hoc way. I didn't really talk about this that much in the piece, but the actual community of users and so forth. But second, and I think more importantly, you know, people associate with groups and activities and identities for various reasons. We get things out of it. And one of those is, you know, our Jewish identities. you know, I think the notion of experience, human experience, shifts with augmented reality in a serious way. Certainly religious experience as a subset of that. So, you know, on the trivial level, I say trivial, but on a simple level, you know, it might be different ways to do Jewish together. You know, whether, I mean, right now it doesn't feel very inspiring to stay Kaddish with a minion online, but, well, what if it is, what if that minion really feels like they're all around you and it's your friends and they're supporting you as you say Kaddish or something like that? But even more radically, you know, as experience changes, the things we look for in our communities change.
So I'm thinking about the impulse to play in the sandbox, like you were talking about. And there's the tribal impulse that says, you know, these are my people, and so, you know, let's play in this, in our sandbox. But I guess that it's more interesting to me, you know, I guess where my optimism is, and I hope that there's a reason to play in the Jewish sandbox because there's something really good in it, right? Like the sand is really good.
We have good shovels and pails.
Good shovels and pails, good sand. Such that it's not even, right? I mean, like you're talking about the that many Jews do a lot of things that reasonably shouldn't be deemed to be Jewish, or, you know, they're not really any more Jewish than anything else. But on the flip side of that, you know, I can imagine a lot of non-Jews that are interested in playing in the Jewish sandbox or with the Jewish sand in the same way that many Jews are interested in playing with the Buddhist sand. And I guess at the end of the day, like, what I'm curious about is this question of, as you see it, going back to that Vonnegut quote, you know, what is the purpose? You know, what is the purpose other than tribal of trying to retain a Judaism that has value? You know, what is it that you think people are looking for in their lives that they are able to potentially get it from institutions like Judaism or like Buddhism or the various other sandboxes in which you try to play?
Yeah, and first, I totally agree, right? I mean, I think ultimately the Judaism worth perpetuating is the Judaism that creates better and better pails and shovels. And I agree that we've already, over the last 2,500 years, created some really good ones. And that's why I'm in it. Partly, I'm sure I'm in it because it is my family and it is my, you know, my roots. But I think the reason that I still, you know, don't give up has to do with, you know, with a very unique set of languages and spiritual technologies and ethical traditions and technologies that we do bring to the table. So, you know, some of those, you know, I think ethical monotheism was a pretty good idea in general. I think we might want to update it a little bit and, you know, depatriarchalize it and reground it in the body and the earth and learn from other traditions as well. But, you know, this is there's incredibly rich traditions of text and of teaching and of poetry and of music and of culture and of justice struggle and a really unique or close to unique positionality relative to Western civilization, the insider outsiders who have been the outsiders within for 1,500 to 2,000 years of diaspora. You know, that's led to some really distinctive perspectives on self and other and on what it is to be a citizen of the West. I do think that, you know, the notion of justice as primary is one that is still something really valuable to think about. For me, in the Theravadan Buddhist world, you know, the Buddha set out to find out why we suffer. He was always asked again and again by teachers to take positions on various other issues, like cosmological issues, like is the earth eternal or was it created? Or, you know, what happens after we die? And, you know, they wanted him to answer these religious doctrinal questions. And in general, you know, he really would draw the questioner back again and again and said, you know, I teach about suffering and the end of suffering. Why do we suffer, you know, as human beings, and what can we do about it? And that, I think, is a profoundly important question. I also think it's a profoundly important question to ask, how can we help each other get through this thing, whatever it is, which, although Kurt Vonnegut wasn't super Jewish, the that quote actually, I think, is. You know, and it actually, I don't think Judaism is primarily interested in suffering and the end of suffering or happiness on a personal level. You know, it's kind of like, how can we minimize suffering on a group level and on an interpersonal level? And those are really valuable pails and shovels to bequeath to the next generation. And in addition to the wealth of the literature and the library and the the experiences that can be offered. I do wonder on the spiritual experience side, which obviously I'm particularly interested in, if those won't be synthesized or synthesizable in just a few decades, that, you know, no matter how awesome your Friday night davening is, your virtual reality experience will be even better. That's an interesting question. It's hypothetical right now, because right now we're just at that 300 baud level. But I think it's clear, too, that there are so many different sets of tools.
You made a point earlier that I would love to return to, or really you just sort of made a reference in passing that I want to return to, because I think it's something that people might not fully be aware of. They might have a subtle awareness, but haven't really explored it much. And that's this phenomenon that there are, as you said, a ton of American Jews who are deeply immersed, not only as participants in American Buddhism, but as leaders of it. And that many of these people, some of them might identify as having left Judaism, but others really don't. And as you've said, balance, you know, teaching Buddhist meditation with, for you, being a rabbi, but for others, just being an involved member of the American Jewish world. And I was wondering if you could just sort of give us a window into that balancing act, if it's a balancing act, and if you know any of the history about how that's sort of evolved, because it really is this fascinating historical thing that percentage-wise, there are just such a disproportionate number of American Jews that have risen to really important roles in Buddhism.
Right. Yeah, no, that is the case. Now I get to plug my book, Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment, which has one chapter on this subject in particular. It evolves in a kind of a mixture of chance and non-chance. You know, a lot of it has to do with American Jewish post-war prosperity and who were the people who were involved in spiritual seeking. So people who had some interest or taste in something spiritual, but not had it met necessarily in the American Jewish post-war context of the 1960s, 50s, 60s, 70s. You know, I'm really in the second generation. The first generation of Boo Jews are baby boomers, who were written about in Roger Kamenetz's The Jew and the Lotus. And it is true, you know, there are three major schools, sects, or streams, I guess, of Buddhism in the West. And one is sort of the mindfulness-y stream, and that's where a lot of the Jewish names are, like Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield. You know, they just came from that particular post-war milieu that also gave us Philip Roth and, you know, all of that sort of angsty culture of that period. In the Zen world, though, as well, there are, you know, leading Jews like Bernie Glassman, for example, one of the most important Zen Buddhist teachers, and a little bit less in the Tibetan world, the Tibetan Buddhist world, so that's the third stream, partly because there are actually a lot of Tibetans who are in positions of leadership, but another Dharma friend of mine, Lama Suryadas, is still very much a Brooklyn Jew in the way he talks and acts and teaches, and, you know, it's actually, for him, I think it's the opposite of a tightrope. Or that's what you said, a balancing act. For him, it's an integration act, and I think that's true for me, too. Hopefully not just an act, you know, that it's about being just true to ourselves and not necessarily, I mean, he does have, right, the Indian name, but he got the Indian name from a guru before he became a Buddhist, actually. But for me, I don't experience it as a balancing act. I mean, there are occasions where I really do want to hang out in Jewish space and time. But I was thinking just on the way over before we did this podcast, like, if I had to do Judaism, you know, as my entire religious path and then my professional life, too, I just would go crazy. I mean, these people are nuts. They're so neurotic, and like the tightness and the thing and the money and the this and the that and the yelling and the Israel and the, oh, my God, it would just drive me bananas. And so there's a lot of times where I just want to get the hell out of there, and I do. And I go off on a silent retreat for a month or, you know, just spend time in some other community, and that's just how I am. I think that's part of just whatever, whether it was genetics or my upbringing or whatever. I don't really care, but it's part of what this personality is like. And so I don't experience it as a balancing act. I do see the sensibilities is very different. But as I said earlier, because of that preponderance of Jews in the American Buddhist scene, it's actually very Jewy there. It's funny to see sometimes what their projections are about what they think Jews are supposed to be like, let alone rabbis. I usually closet the rabbi part when I go off into Buddha land. just because I don't want to hold people's projections of what they think a rabbi is supposed to be. But, you know, it feels very, at this point, very natural, partly because, you know, for me, the essence of the Dharma practice is really just being with what is, seeing things clearly, letting go a little bit more easily, not getting quite as caught by pushing away the unpleasant or grabbing onto the pleasant. Very simple stuff. Like, there's great esoteric Buddhism, too, that's at least as Baroque as anything in the Kabbalah. But for me, the simple stuff works the best.
Earlier on, you alluded to sort of this secret history of Metallica or whatever phenomenon that happens in the foreword. I'm curious if you can just sort of give a lay of the land. I mean, we haven't talked about Jewish journalism at all. We haven't really talked about the Jewish press on our show. And I feel like its role is really important. I mean, people really do, I mean, certain segments of the Jewish population really do pay attention to the foreword, to JTA, to these kinds of big ticket Jewish publications, and occasionally their local Jewish papers too. And I was just curious if you could give us an overview of how the Jewish press is looking right now, and if it relates at all to these questions of nationalism, tribalism, of hybridization with other traditions. I mean, all of the things we've talked about, sort of how does Jewish journalism play a role there, if at all?
Sure. So, yeah, I think there's two worlds, right? The American and the Israeli scene. And the Israeli scene really is under siege right now. You know, it's one of the untold stories of the Netanyahu administration that there's been a real curtailing of press freedom. And, you know, with Sheldon Adelson funding Israel Hayom and with other right-wing funders involved in the Israeli media, you know, it's really hard for Haaretz to kind of continue holding out just as the, you know, this one bastion. I think they will hold out, certainly for a while, but it's, you know, it's a darkening situation in Israel for journalists. You know, here in the United States, no one knows how to make money doing journalism, really, so the Jews are not alone necessarily. I think there are some pretty admirable efforts to pivot, both from the Forward and JTA, who've really kind of shaken up what they do in the last few years, and others. You know, it's a challenging financial proposition when you're reaching an audience that's as small as the American Jewish audience is from a large, you know, advertiser's point of view. So, you know, it's always going to be worth it for the new Natalie Portman movie to take ads in the Forward, as they have, but not necessarily the old Natalie Portman movie, by which I mean Star Wars. So, you know, it's
right.
Just not,
right.
And there's more money in Star Wars, definitely. Than, so, you know, just from the models that do work, it's a tricky time. And, you know, I just won an award from the American Jewish Press Association. I'm really excited by that. You know, and it's tricky in terms of transition because a lot of the, you know, a lot of the sort of philanthropic supporters of Jewish press, local and national, are interested in the more kind of sentimental thing, and that's one reason that they fund it, and God bless them, because they pay my rent. But figuring out how that transitions to the next generation in the Jewish journalism side, I think, is absolutely a kind of an open question. You know, on a macro scale, I wonder if it'll be a little bit similar to Judaism in general, which is that there still will be these kinds of larger institutions, but they may not be the ones where the real dynamism is happening. You know, and it may well be that the better funded Jewish journalistic outlets, which are more nationalistic and which publish stuff which I think, you know, would be called racist if it weren't in a Jewish publication on a regular basis, those may end up being dominant if the community as a whole, you know, really does reflect and support that more nationalistic orientation. As it happens, they really don't. You know, people do vote with their feet, and American Jews are still relatively progressive politically and are still more or less integrated than interested, I should say, in culture more broadly. So, but if the community shifts and really supports those kinds of more ethnocentric, you know, this is what we do kinds of publications, that may well be the future. And then, you know, the talented Jewish American writers will do what I do. You know, I most of my writing isn't for the Forward, right? So now I'm speaking to you from the Daily Beast office. I love working here. You know, I'm right across the way from Gideon Resnick, who's Jewish, and other people. You know, a lot of people who have Jewish names and Jewish identities. And it's hard to make a case for a vital, interesting writer staying in the Jewish fold if places like the Forward, I don't want to like seem like I'm pushing the Forward because I do work there, but you know, if places like that can't make it in the long term.
I wanted to go back to what you talked about at the very beginning of our conversation when we were talking about sensibilities, and you talked about recently thinking about or writing about the gay sensibility. And I was particularly interested in your thoughts on the LGBTQ sort of story within Judaism of the last decade or two. You know, we've talked about it here and there over the course of the show, but you know, I'm curious about your thinking in terms of, I mean, let me put it this way. I have a sense that the story of the, you know, LGBTQ folks and Judaism is one that actually provides potentially some kind of roadmap for optimism. But I'm wondering if you think it's sui generis or there are other things sort of going on there. Yeah, my basic sense is that, you know, however many years ago when the Jewish community was for the most part not welcoming of LGBTQ Jews, somehow there were enough LGBTQ Jews who cared about being Jewish. You know, somehow there was a critical mass such that rather than all going away, that many of them created LGBTQ Jewish organizations in a way that I see less of among, for example, Jewish atheists or other kinds of people that might feel that the way that the Jewish community is organized is not welcoming to them, whether that's from an identity standpoint or a point of view standpoint. And then I feel that what happened in LGBTQ synagogues and organizations like Svara was this really interesting Judaism that emerged and that turned out to be interesting and relevant to people who weren't gay and lesbian, you know, who weren't LGBTQ. And that somehow that experience turned out to be useful and helpful to all kinds of other Jews that felt excluded. And obviously that wasn't its purpose. Its purpose was to help this specific group of Jews who needed that at that time in their lives. But I guess I'm wondering if you see that story in a similar way, or if there are ways in which the LGBTQ Jewish story continues to be actually sort of one of the more important pieces of the future of the Jewish story, and or are there things that other groups can learn from it to say that we can go about things differently?
Yeah, no, I think that's it. Those are a really interesting set of points, and I'm basically in agreement with what you said. I mean, the case study I often mention is Congregation Beis Chavarim in Atlanta, which, you know, started out as LGBT, but then because it was LGBT, they were a little bit more innovative, a little bit more liberal, and a little bit more politically engaged than the other congregations in Atlanta, and attracted just a lot of people who wanted that environment. So they weren't LGBT identified, but they did, but they wanted those things, right? And so, you know, they then had the question that a lot of LGBTQ synagogues will now be facing. In fact, I think, you know, most already have just in the recent past, you know, which is how important that identity remains. You know, do we say that we, I think the Beis Chavarim uses the language, if I'm not mistaken, of we have roots in the LGBT community, but branches elsewhere, da-da-da-da, way of finessing it. They do have a, you know, wonderful gay rabbi, my friend Josh Lesser, and they have a lot of LGBTQ people there, but it's majority straight now because there was something that was innovative, interesting, good, you know, a little bit more progressive and a little more politically, active. So I do think that offers a model. You know, I think the much bigger elephant in the room are multi-faith families. And it was interesting, back when I used to do LGBT Jewish work, when I was running an organization called Nahirim, there was a big study that came out about inclusion that focused on three groups, LGBT, Jews of color, and intermarried or multi-faith families. And they, you know, the shocking bit of data was that actually the experiences were almost identical across these three very different groups, right? I mean, the difference markers of those three groups are just very different, right? So Jews of color tended to be, they're from, you know, in families that were also, you know, not white or not entirely white, right? Whereas LGBT didn't. Obviously, multi-faith families, these are people coming in, like very different vectors, but the same kinds of things seem to matter in terms of inclusion. So, you know, visibility, a certain kind of specific kinds of welcome, and so on. There's, you know, whole sort of trainings that now happen about how to just do diversity trainings in synagogues. And it is curious, you know, there was just the news recently that one of the major multi-faith Jewish organizations is going through some cuts. And, you know, there's a big Jewish multi-faith conference taking place in Philadelphia, which could be really interesting. You know, I think in terms of numbers, you know, that's a group that really does dwarf the LGBT community in terms of its size and its percentage of the Jewish community. Again, it seems like so much of what we've talked about, it's like, do you choose the optimistic or the pessimistic perspective? You know, my optimistic perspective, you know, I just remember before in the conservative movement, I was a little bit active in, you know, working on their LGBT stuff. And there really were, people were saying like the sky would fall if the conservative movement allowed, you know, gay rabbis, let alone gay marriages. Like this would be the end of the conservative movement as we know it. You know, in retrospect, it was really at the beginning, right? It was this, like, this fake issue that was kind of an albatross sitting, you know, hanging around the conservative movement's neck, and all they could talk about were, like, gay rabbis, when in fact there were much deeper systemic issues that they needed to be addressing, which now I think they are, you know, under new leadership and so on, and without that kind of fake focus point. You know, it's like that wasn't really the issue. There were other issues that were more important. So the sky didn't fall. The conservative movement in particular, of course, that like the other movements, they're having their struggles, but I think they're in a much better place now than when they were, you know, so afraid to take a step. And maybe that'll be true for multi-faith or not. You know, I don't know. But it does feel like that to me, you know, the percentage of Jews who are non-white, the Jews of color, is still relatively small. Obviously, that'll increase in the next generation. But I think on the multi-faith side, we're talking about a group that's really much larger. And so I'm curious to see how that develops.
Jay, it's sort of in closing, I'm curious if you mentioned earlier, you talked about the Haredization of American Judaism. I'm curious if that's how you see it. Like, do you think that the future or a likely future of American Judaism is one with a growing, I mean, it already is, but that trend will continue, the sort of growing and more dominant Haredi ultra-Orthodox community? Or do you think, you know, I remember a few years ago, in Israel, they were talking about how once the Haredi community reaches a certain size, it kind of can't be the Haredi community as we know it anymore, because they're just going to be too many people to support in the way that they've tended to support themselves. And people are going to have to go out and start getting jobs and doing all kinds of things that they're going to be exposed to the wider world. And, you know, everything that caused the ultra-Orthodox immigrants to America in the early part of the 20th century to go in another direction will essentially happen again. And I'm curious what you think about that, and also whether the people coming out of that are potentially a source of the kind of creative leadership that we might imagine for liberal Judaism, you know, in part because they're you know, they have had excellent educations and have a lot of sands to mix up.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think, you know, from your mouth to God's ears, that the Haredi community will have to just grow up and get a job. I don't think that's true, certainly in America, and even in Israel, it doesn't, I don't know. For, yeah, like I said, from your mouth to God's ears. No, my favorite subject that I'll talk about for, you know, for free all the time is that I do think that the mainstream organized Jewish community just has not recognized or is not acting on these obvious demographic shifts that are happening. You know, if it were up to me, little tiny programs like Footsteps here in the States and Hillel over in Israel, which help Haredi Jews who want to leave, which just helps them adjust, which is an incredibly difficult transition. You know, I'm sure a lot of listeners have read Sholem Dean's book, All Who Go Do Not Return, and there's a whole literature now of ex-Orthodox writers. You know, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do on so many different levels, leaving the family, and they don't have skills to support themselves in the modern job economy, and just getting used to secular society. And I mean, it just, each one of those is a huge burden, and we do almost nothing for them as a Jewish community. You know, and we make it's almost like we're making it as hard to leave as possible. You know, I don't think that non-Haredi Jews need to like advertise on bus stops and convince all Haredim to leave. But I think we could at least make it as easy as possible to do so. you know, we're sitting very comfortably not recognizing the threat of Jewish fundamentalism to all of the Jewish values that we've talked about so far. And it is Jewish fundamentalism. That's what it is. It's not different from Islamic fundamentalism. It's not different from the way that certain parts of America now to be a Christian means to be basically a Christian fundamentalist. And that is happening. It, as you said, it's not a future tense prediction. It's a present tense read of what the data is. You know, this is what's actually happening. And not only is the mainstream not helping people who want to leave, they're propping up the leadership by dispensing insane amounts of aid and charity, basically through the rabbinic establishment and through the elite, which just further empowers the elite over everybody else. So I'm not one who feels that we need to go crusading in Haredi communities and liberate women and, you know, do everything and assume that we know best. But we do know that a lot of people want to leave those repressive contexts, and we're not doing anything to help them. And we're hurting ourselves in that respect, because I definitely agree with your leading question that aren't ex-Haredi also, you know, sources of a lot of creativity and stuff. And if you just look, you know, among some of the most fascinating artists, Tel Aviv or New York or elsewhere, you know, they're coming from formerly Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox contexts. They've broken the safer barrier. That's the Reb Zalmanism. You know, they're able to crack open a Jewish book. But more than that, they really grew up steeped in a very rich environment. And now, you know, they have the capacity if they want to. You know, the majority don't. They just want to get on with their lives. But people like Shalom, you know, want to share it with this wider world. And so we're hurting ourselves doubly. We're depriving ourselves of the gifts of this population. And, you know, we're helping the slow motion demographic shift that ultimately portends very, very badly for the American Jewish community.
You know, you sort of know our big picture point of view on this podcast, and what we're trying to put out there is ideas that potentially allow new approaches to arise that involve Jews who are not finding connection with existing Jewish organizations in developing new expressions of Judaism and new organizations and new things that are going on outside the existing Jewish community. And from your own experience or as an observer, just curious if there's anything that we haven't discussed yet with you that you think is really important that you just want to have a chance to say in closing.
One of my gigs is going around as a scholar in residence to synagogues. And I've seen a lot of really interesting and sincere work going on, even within mainstream synagogues. Now, I think my sample space is biased because these are only the synagogues that were brilliant enough to invite me, right? So they're all above average. But even so, you know, there is actually, I mean, I think for many of us, that model, it's hard to see that model being sustainable, and it's hard to see it really being even desirable. Like, it's not the Jewish world we'd want to live in, the kind of big box shul, you know, out in the suburbs and so on. But for some people, that does meet their needs, and I want to not seem like I'm flagging that off. I think there's actually a lot of innovative stuff happening. And, you know, I think it's again, sort of a question of, like, connecting people in those contexts with the types of Jewishness that might be of interest to them. Just recently, the Isabella Friedman Jewish Retreat Center in Connecticut had a weekend, a singing weekend, people coming together, and it's like 200 people or something came together to sing Jewish songs all weekend, which to me sounds like a total nightmare. But for them, right, that's really exciting. And each, you know, those people can all go back to their communities, right? And I would say, I don't know who's going, my hunch would be that the majority of them are in more traditional synagogue communities, that they can go back and kind of pollinate, you know, with the experience that they've had at the Jewish song weekend. And that's, I think, you know, there is a lot of good stuff happening even within those synagogue communities. And that kind of a model, you know, where the people who are interested in eco go do eco, and the people who are interested in social justice work go do that, and then they bring that in. That's that kind of more food court model rather than a restaurant seems to be thriving even within, you know, existing edifices across the country. So I wanted to just put in that plug, not necessarily for that old system, but for just noticing that we're not necessarily starting to reinvent the wheel with nothing, that there's a lot going on within the more conventional context that can be enlivened.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we were talking a while ago about the idea connected to this of tzimtzum, right? The idea that in traditional theology, you know, God makes himself smaller in order to make more room for human beings to take more responsibility. And, you know, it's really interesting because I totally agree with you that sometimes some of the conversation that we have could be heard by people to say, you know, it's down on existing Jewish institutions or it's pessimistic about them. But I totally agree with you. That's not how I feel either. What I think is more the case is that, you know, when you were once the big restaurant and now it's an environment of food courts being kind of what's needed, do you have the capacity, the internal emotional capacity and the financial capacity too, to say, okay, we're going to change our business model and now we're going to be happily become one of the stations at the food court? And we're still going to serve the same food. What the food we serve is excellent. It's just we don't have to make the claim that this is the only kind of food there is, or this is the only kind of food that's reasonable. And not only that, but we can actually, by joining the food court, you know, we actually potentially are providing resources and encouragement to the development of new approaches that are different from ours. And so we can happily live in a food court. I really love the image.
Oh, no, forget it. You don't sing my tune to Kedusha. You're not Jewish.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jay. It's really been a great pleasure having you on the show.
My pleasure. And I'm really glad that the work you're doing is out there in the world. And so keep up with that.
Well, we'll certainly do our best. Thanks again to Jay Michelson for a great episode. We really appreciate you coming onto the show. And we want to close this episode out in the same way we always do by encouraging you to please be in touch with us. And the first way for you to do that is through our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. You can also be in touch via email. You can reach us at lex@nextjewishfuture.org or dan@nextjewishfuture.org. And third, you've got our website, judaismunbound.com, where we post show notes for this episode and all of our other along with some other great resources. And the last thing we like to mention is that we have our Patreon page where you can make a small monthly donation to support the work that we do. And the way for you to do that is to head to www.patreon.com, that's patreon.com/Judaism Unbound. Thanks again for listening, and this has been Judaism Unbound.